Hello, and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, NPR correspondent Arti Shahani discusses her memoir, Here We Are, American Dreams, American Nightmares, with fellow NPR correspondent Sonari Rhodes-Glinton. This conversation was recorded live at the American Writers Museum in October of 2019. This program was the first in a series of programs presented in conjunction with our special exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today, which you can explore virtually at my-america.org. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Our program tonight is a little bit special. It's the first in a series sponsored by Gene and John Rowe in conjunction with our new upcoming exhibit, My America, Immigrant and Refugee Writers Today. And so tonight, we start this program and this exhibit and this initiative, and in this first event, we welcome Arti Shahani to talk more about her own American story and her new memoir, Here We Are. She's the NPR correspondent for Silicon Valley, and before journalism, Shahani was a community organizer in her native New York City, helping prisoners and families facing deportation. She's joined by her former colleague at NPR, Sonari Glinton, CEO of Delight Media, and I want to say welcome to you both, and we're excited to have you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
I can't hear myself. Is this thing on? I'm going to do that. Well, welcome, Arti.
Thank you.
Congratulations on the book.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to say to you all, it's kind of a weird sensation to read a book as compelling as this by someone you know, right? Because, you know, that's the weird thing, because I always think of the number of our colleagues who've written books or done things, and the only other analogous situation that I will tell this little anecdote was Ari Shapiro was the host of All Things Considered. About a decade ago, he's like, I'm standing at his desk, and he goes, hey, you want to listen to my song? And I'm like, dear Lord, no. Like, in my head, I was like, I can't act. I can't tell. I'm like, what if it's terrible? And I'm standing at his desk, and I'm listening, and I'm like, oh my God, I like this. This is great. And this is analogous because what I would say is the weird sensation is that, you know, you meet someone and you're like, if I could only get her drunk or stoned, like there's so many more things that I need to know. And that for me, that's what the book works on so many levels, because it's like that moment.
Yeah.
And then I honestly think that it is one of it works
well,
on multiple
I remember
levels.
You telling me after you read it that you had been prepared to hate it, and you just politely took a copy from me.
I was like, oh, I'll have to read this book. But so But so it works on multiple levels, and I wanted to congratulate
Thank you.
For, as I've said to people before, Arti has spent a lifetime breaking the curve. Thank you for breaking the curve for us NPR folks, because you put your heart in this book, and it meant a lot to me.
Yeah, you literally literally the book is just my heart on a page. That's what it is. So I was literally thinking that as you were saying it. Yeah.
So I think the place to start would be to talk about your father. I'm going to have you read a little, but I stole a description from your notes, to just from some, you know, things that I know. Your dad, he was a shopkeeper.
That's right.
One of my favorite details is that you say he wore Velcro sneakers from Payless and Rayon shirts. He worked 7 days a week. But your dad was arrested and taken to Rikers because he mistakenly sold watches and calculators to a drug cartel. And we all think of, you know, immigrants are in cash businesses, right? That's a huge part of this story. And you were going to read from the book to give a sense of who he is.
Yeah. So, you know, and I will just say that the memoir, it's a piece of my family's immigrant journey, and it's focused a lot on me and Dad. Sonari, as you were just saying, just in broad brush strokes, my family came here when I was a toddler. My siblings, my parents, and I, we came here. We overstayed tourist visas. We became undocumented. Then we got our papers through a process that is now derided as chain migration, but whenever I've heard that term, I just think it sounds wonderful. I'm like, oh yeah, links on the chain, big family, strong family. That's what we all want. But, you know, it's sort of, we're in a moral crisis right now. We don't hear things clearly. But we got our papers, and then we thought, straight shot to the American dream. And in fact, another detail about my dad, besides the fact that he wore his Velcro sneakers from Payless, and thank you for remembering that, is I didn't like him growing up. I've written a book that has kind of two parts to it. So my father was arrested for selling watches and calculators to a drug cartel. His private lawyer whom we hired said, Mr. Shahani, just plead guilty. Because if you don't plead guilty and if you go to trial, you're going to face a trial penalty. You could do a decade. You could do 15 years. You don't want that. Dad's a shopkeeper. Didn't really have the resources to put up a fight against the state. But the 8-month sentence that he accepted ended up spiraling into a 14-year legal battle anyway, because deportation became a second surprise punishment for my father. So when I mentioned to you, this is set up for the excerpt you've just asked me to read, when I mentioned that I didn't really like my father, what I meant by that is growing up, like a lot of kids, he's just this guy I didn't know. He was out working. He came home. He smoked his Marlboros in a corner. Didn't talk to me except to say that your skirt's too short or your shirt's too tight. And I just thought, I didn't care who he was, but I had this sense that he got in the way of my freedom. That's how I felt about him. When he was first arrested, the first time I went to Rikers Island jail where he was held and I visited him, I was horrifically ashamed of him. I wanted to be a prosecutor when I grew up. So I just was like, what is my father doing here?
You know, one of the things, things that I really struck me because, you know, speaking of similarities, when you speak about how, you know, you went to a fancy school.
Yeah.
And one of the things you said that really stuck out was that you felt that your parents were small. Mm. You wrote that. And that, Where do you think that came from? Does it come from being an American girl, going to a school and thinking like, oh, I have these immigrant parents?
I just think it's real. I mean, I think a lot of us feel like our parents are small, and I just said it, you know? Like, I think that a lot of us, and in part, there is something about American culture, right? The sort of this notion of the dream that anyone can achieve it, and the nature of the dream is that you get to go to places that your family, your parents, where you come from can't go. That's the nature of it, is to walk into secret doors, to be able to leap forward away from where you started. That's the nature of the dream. So, you know, I was a precocious scholarship kid at a private school in Manhattan that costs, in modern day terms, a Tesla a year to attend. And it's actually funny, the contrast between my private school and Rikers Island, because at private school, I had never seen so many white bodies in person, because I grew up in an incredibly multi-ethnic neighborhood in Queens. I would argue where I grew up is actually the DNA of this country. This country is a fusion, a constant fusion, and that was my exposure, working class UN. I get to Brearley, and I'm like, wow. And I learned really crazy terms, like country house. A country house is a home that is not your first home. It is a second home. I grew up in a one-bedroom crap apartment where there were so many roaches, the five of us, one bedroom, there were so many roaches. I literally woke up more than once with a roach crawling up my bare skin. That's how I grew up. So to come into a world where suddenly, oh my God, it's so elite. It's racially so different. As a public school kid, I was super excited to have my parents come to parent-teacher day because they were just going to hear, oh, Arthie's a nerd girl, you know. At my private school, I didn't want my parents coming, even before Dad was arrested, because I'm like, people just treat them like the help, right? That kind of dynamic. A very familiar dynamic, I think. I've heard, at least while talking to people.
Yeah, I went to a fancy school, right? I went to St. Ignatius for those here, Someone said, I love that. And Arthie went to a very similar school, all girls.
We have similar journeys that way. Go ahead. Yeah, please.
No, but that is, I mean, to me, that is that moment of your shame, thinking like, oh, my friends' dads are prosecutors and work for Goldman and things like that. Yeah. And I'm going here to Rikers to visit my immigrant father.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's a cultural experience for him, clearly, because he's in his 50s when this happens. He's not like the other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many details about him before even going in to prison that really stunned me. But I'd like you to, this is the good time to
Sure, yeah. Let me, so, you know, the first time I had visited Dad at the very beginning of the sort of legal case, and we're going to Rikers feeling ashamed of him, but I had this little fleeting thought in the back of my mind, which is, where are all the white criminals? I didn't see a single one in the visitation room, huge visitation room. This feels like fitting music for what I'm about to read. And I just want to acknowledge it. We're going to bring it into the story. As the years passed, and I became an undergrad at the University of Chicago, and I stopped going to college because when we learned that the criminal case was not just an 8-month sentence, but it was going to be a second surprise punishment of deportation, and my family was unraveling rapidly, and my father had lost all of his teeth, and he was suffering from heart disease, and everything was going badly. I basically thought, my dad is going to Rikers for 8 months, and it will be a death sentence or a life sentence. A death sentence because in 8 months, he could easily die in this jail. And I needed to stop going to UChicago, and I needed to be home, because I needed to be there for that call when it came in telling me your father is dead. And if not that, a life sentence, because after the 8 months we had come to find out after pleading, he was going to be subject to automatic exile from this country, even though he was a green card holder and he had U.S. citizen family members. Didn't matter. During that year off from UChicago, it ended up being a year that I was hustling a lot. I visited Dad at Rikers quite a bit. And I want to read you a passage from one of the visits that I did. It took 3 hours to get to the last checkpoint, the open-air gym with the tiny tables. There was one woman standing in line in front of me, and she had enormous breasts. I could see a third of them heaving from her V-neck. "Oh my goodness, I hope I recognize him," she turned back and told me. "Huh?" I didn't understand. "My girlfriend set me up. I can't tell which one he is." "You haven't met before?" "No, but he's going to be out soon." This woman was at Rikers Island on a first date. A blind first date. I wanted to shake her. "Girl, I love a captive audience too, but this is taking it too far. Wait till he's out." "Good luck," were the words I managed to mouth. A corrections officer pointed to the tiny table where she'd meet her man, no guesswork required, and then pointed me to Dad. "You look tired, my doll," he said as we sat down. "No, I'm good." "Are you eating enough?" "Yeah, Dad, I'm eating plenty." That question got on my nerves. Mom, who was still vomiting multiple times a day, would ask it to me too. And sensing my irritation, she'd latch on, persisting either as martyr mom, "Arthi, I ask because I'm your mother," or as infomercial mom, "I have homeopathic pills, try them." Dad had the sense to back off. I gave him the London debrief, ending with how Ange went missing. He laughed a deep laugh. That daughter of his could brighten any day. She was so different from him and me that way, a constant reminder of how good it could be if you just let loose sometimes. A few tables over, an inmate sprung from his steel chair and threw it against the wall. Guards raced over and pinned his face and shoulders down. I thought they were about to call off visitation for everyone. They didn't. They just dragged him away. "You're not where you thought you'd be, huh?" I said to Dad. He shook his head. "No, not at all," he said without saying. The silence lingered for a moment. Conversation didn't come naturally. Inside jail, outside, it always took effort with us. "How'd you learn Arabic?" I decided to try the interview approach. "Did you have books? Tapes?" "My father was a migrant worker in Beirut starting as a teenager. He went there when he was 19 so that he could support his family of 13. No, I learned by attending the customers, he said. Each day I listened for the important words. Slowly, slowly, I picked up very good Arabic. Important words like what? Kaif halakum, barak alafik, arak lahikan, ana ahubuk habibti. How are you? God bless you. See you. You are my love. That last one stood out. Who taught you that? I asked. There's no way Dad's boss taught it to him. It's a funny thing. You make me go back so many years. He smiled and hesitated for a moment. It was an Armenian girl. She asked me for a date. She said in Arabic, as well as in Armenian, Ana Abuka, I love you. Did you say it back to her? I was nervous. I was shocked. I never had a girlfriend. I never went out with anybody. It was strange for me to hear someone say that. But we did go to see a movie. It was In the Heat of the Night. That was the Sidney Poitier film where an African-American detective goes to the Deep South and gets wrongfully arrested for the murder of a white businessman. Dad was a 25-year-old migrant worker out with an Armenian flight attendant watching a movie about American race relations. My first date was Boys in the Hood. I was in seventh grade, out with a Chinese-American boy who won my heart because he could name every highway that crossed through Queens. Neither Dad nor I were allowed to date. I didn't mention these parallels. He continued. In the theater, I came to know she spoke English too. I didn't know that before. We came out of the theater. We spoke English, French, Arabic. It was nice. I began to imagine what she looked like in the dark. If Dad turned to see her profile or just stared straight ahead the whole time. If their fingers or forearms brushed as they strolled the beach after the movie. If they listened to the waves lap or if she found conversation with him more easily than I did. They met when she came to the tourist trap where he worked. She bought leather sandals and brass vases, little trinkets for family and friends. She came back again and again. Then one day she asked if he had time for coffee. At the time, I didn't have permission. The bosses were strict. On some Sundays, I was allowed to leave. So we went for coffee a few times, but the cinema was just once. Why not more? I asked him. You love movies. Because I couldn't afford it. She's spending money all the time. I didn't like that. I had limited pocket expenses. I had to think of my family first. When I went back to India, she wrote me a letter. She said, I'm waiting for you. And she sent me a photo. She told me, show to your family. Did you? I asked. Yes, I showed them. My mother, brothers, sisters. They said, who's that girl? Are you taking up the foreign way? Having a girlfriend? Dad shrugged. I didn't much bother about it because I knew I wouldn't be able to and also take care of my family. I see. I began to paraphrase, because you knew if you were going to pursue a relationship, you couldn't send as much money back home. So you either could have a girlfriend or be a good son. Yes, that's true. I felt sorry for young Dad and this Armenian romantic who thought love could transcend distance. Dad hadn't answered my question, which I repeated. Okay, so then did you ever tell her, I love you back? No, I didn't say anything, he laughed at himself. I was nervous and just smiling and putting my head down like a girl. I'm sorry to say, but a fact is a fact. Time's up, a guard called out to us. Time never flies with Dad. This was a first. As I boarded the white bus that went to the visitor center, the woman who'd had her blind date slipped onto the bench beside me. How'd it go? I felt obligated to ask her. Really well. She smiled ear to ear. We're going to see each other again. That's great, I feigned approval. Yes, I was judging her. Though the uncanny resemblance was not lost on me. She was at Rikers, getting to know a stranger. So was I.
Well, you know, you say that you put your heart in this book, and one of the first questions I thought of was, you know, so often as journalists, we are told that we are not the story, and for the most part, I agree. You know, A lot of times, it was just an example. I was looking at a Monday, a morning show, and a guy brought his daughter on to ask someone questions. And I was like, you know what? There was a cuter kid than that. Okay. Like, you shouldn't have put yourself in the story. You shouldn't put the kid in that.
Yeah. But did you see the picture that went viral today of the little kid who came on? His mom was on BBC, and then he came on, and he was like pulling her. It was hilarious.
Oh, okay. No, I didn't see it.
Anyway,
but I think about this as a so-called objective reporter. Mm. I know you're reluctant to write this book. What was the thing that made you do it?
There's no such thing as objectivity. This is a...
That's in quotes, by the way.
Yeah. No, we both know it. I mean, we've talked about it. Mm-hmm. But this is actually an important... I'm not sidestepping your question. I'm going into it. In newsrooms, there's this myth that the reporter is objective. No human is objective. So I don't understand how the reporter is. And unfortunately, I think what happens is that becomes carte blanche for people to just ignore the fact of their biases. I wish that we were all more self-aware. This book is my greatest effort at self-awareness. As an investigative reporter, I have never interviewed more people in my life for a story. About 100 to put this together. Including the judge who sent my father away. But layered on to the memories I was collecting, the things that I read to piece together what was happening, is the emotional journey. And I think that the truth exists a lot there. You can recount facts. This happened, and that happened, and that happened, and that happened. But the truth of it is the significance. So to go back to Queens Criminal Court and to remember being a kid sitting in those benches and watching my father, who had a soft voice, hearing him try to speak up, hearing him try to explain himself, and the judge saying, Mr. Shahani, I suggest you speak with your lawyer. And my father wasn't like me. He wasn't hyperverbal. He wasn't trying to have a say. My father grew up for his life as part of low-end globalization. He was uprooted from where he was born in 1947 when the British left in a hurry, the Indian subcontinent. He was destined to be a lifelong migrant. He had the sense he didn't matter. So for me, this book has the tools of journalism. I use a lot of dialogue, as you know, as you can hear, I use a lot of dialogue in the story, and that's reconstructed from people telling me what they recall saying themselves and what I recall, et cetera, et cetera. The tools of journalism are there, but I think that the blessing of being a writer is you get to delve into the deeper truth, you know.
So then, mm-hmm. Well, if you can't be objective, the follow that I would have is... Well, then how do you go back then, or like now that you've written this book, uh-huh. that is your heart and soul on the page, how do you go back to, you know, doing the story about, you know, Walmart or something? How do you go back to, the, you know, oh, there's a new Apple i10. How do you do that?
The analogy I'm thinking about, and like, bear with me, it's kind of like if you've ever had like an incredibly hot and steamy romance that you're done with. You really like light touches between. I don't know if that really worked. But I mean, I think that you're also – that's actually also me copping out from giving you a real answer. The real answer is that journalism was my escape from being an immigrant daughter. Okay. A lot of us escape what we come from. In subtle ways and dramatic ways. Journalism is my second career. When I discovered that my father was going to be exiled from this country and my family could be torn apart, I couldn't fathom it. I mentioned I'd stop going to school. I fought for him. I did not know I would be fighting for a decade. I was 16 when Dad was arrested. I was 30 when it finally ended. I didn't know that my life would be so structured around keeping him in this country. I had no idea. I became an activist in the process. I fought with other people who were being fought for other people being deported. I started a nonprofit. Like all these things I didn't mean to do, but just happened in the process of being an immigrant daughter. And when it was done, my credit score sucked. And I was 30, and I was burned out, and I was sad, and I was like ugly sad, like the lay on the sofa, eat the Doritos, then eat the ice cream, and pass out without brushing your teeth while watching Will and Grace. Like that was me, and I needed an out. And so my out was I accidentally or unintentionally or serendipitously applied to graduate school because a best friend of mine was applying. She was applying to school at Harvard, and I'm like, oh, I can apply somewhere? And I had forgotten that my fate and my father's were different. The case broke him. It wasn't his first rodeo. It was his last. And I had a hard time seeing that I had a future beyond that pain. And so it was interesting because when my friend mentioned that she was going to do this thing, I was like, there's a door. And I peeled myself up and walked through it. And that resulted in a very quick pivot into journalism. And why did I go into tech in Silicon Valley? Objective is a key thing. It doesn't exist, but a lot of newsroom editors think it does. So if you work at Goldman Sachs or if your dad works at Goldman, you are perfectly qualified to be a reporter. If you were locked up or your father was locked up, you are not qualified to be a criminal justice reporter. Okay? That's objectivity at work. So I chose Silicon Valley because it was an incredibly safe distance from anything I'd come from, and I knew that the editors who could give me a job, who could make or break my future, would trust that I could do it.
Because you're the Indian tech girl.
I think of myself, like basically if you've heard my voice before, with my friends, I call myself Indian IT lady. If you know me, that's the version of me you know.
But you know, to me, it's amazing reading the book, the difference between you, the career up until 30 and then what comes after. Mm. And then, like, the person I know. I know her. Like, I've seen her in the world. And it was like, you know, I've seen you question people. And I'm like, whew. Like, that is, like, whoa. Mm. Like, she, like, you don't... Why use a fly swatter when an elephant gun would do is the way I think of the way I think of you. It's like, oh. No, it's like, no, I'm not like she's never effing around. Mm. But they're so different and so little it felt in some ways like directly related. What did you feel like a dissonance between like this really active career going to the Supreme Court, trying to save your dad, starting a nonprofit in college, you know, dealing with all these immigrant groups and then turning to be sort of, I don't know, the establishment in Silicon Valley. I mean, that's like a whiplash. Did it feel that way going through it?
Yeah, it did. I mean, I was running on adrenaline, anxiety, and hope. All of it. Like, I needed to get the hell away from where I came from. So I just ran as fast as I could.
Well, this brings me to a really, like, a scene that in the book that is really, and it's sort of threaded throughout the book. Like, you did a very, what in my mind is a very ballsy, arty thing to do, is, like, go meet the judge who sentenced your dad. And there are two parts of it that are interesting to me. One, that he said, he told you in his home that your dad should have never pleaded guilty.
Yeah.
And he was essentially saying this case had been moved to Queens. Like if it was a really high profile case, it would have been in Manhattan. Mm-hmm. This would have been an easy case. And the second thing that he said,
they weren't the players. They got played. That's it. We just got played. That's it. Anyway, sorry.
Oh, and then the second part was the other part is that when you were a teenager, you wrote to this judge.
Mm-hmm.
A lot.
Yeah.
And so he was really, he seemed affected by it. And he said something that what's funny is like in the book, I was like, you seem to be struggling with this. And it's not an issue for me because it's really clear right now. It's like, oh, I thought you would be doing something. I don't know if you said greater or different or more than journalism.
Yeah.
And it bugged you.
Well, yeah. I mean, what happened, and it's funny because I think that the judge is... Our relationship is complicated, okay? this man who hit the gavel and played a role in destroying my father's life as well as my uncle. My uncle and father were involved in the case together. My dad's little brother ran the store too. I'd first written to the judge because I told you the 8-month sentences. My uncle, instead of serving 8 months, served 2.5 years because of an administrative error by New York State. And we'd spent a lot of time trying to get the lawyers to fix it, but the lawyers couldn't fix it. So on the eve of my 20th birthday, I was literally in Hyde Park. Wherever I live, I seem to have roaches. So, in Flushing, I had roaches. In Hyde Park, I had monster roaches. I literally remember roach scuttling across my floor. I'm sitting on my mattress. I'm writing to this judge. And I was basically, dear judge, my uncle's being held wrongfully and laid out what was happening. And much to my surprise, he responded within a handful of days. And he ordered all of the lawyers to come into court. He scolded all of them. He got my uncle released. That's actually when we learned about deportation, because my uncle, who was supposed to do 8 months, did 2.5 years, and then his homecoming party turned into a search party because he went missing for 4 days. And then I kept writing to the judge there was so much going wrong in this case. So fast forward, I thought that I was getting the meeting with him because I'm a fancy NPR correspondent. Anyone will take my call. What I came to realize when actually meeting with him is that he vividly remembered me as a child. And then I believe my take on it is that he projected a lot onto me. When I went to sit down and talk with him, we had two meetings. One was in his private chambers. I had no intention of writing a book. I just went to his private chambers because random life circumstances made that meeting possible and kind of threw it in my lap. This is the beginning of my book. I explain it. And when he first told me from where he was sitting, he just saw two guys, my dad and uncle, who got a real bum deal. And man, it could have been better than they got. Isn't that too bad? He always told it to me as though we were teacher and student dissecting a piece of case law. And he didn't get that what he was saying, literally I felt the spirit leave my body. It was horrifically painful. I didn't know that I had any trauma. I didn't know I had trauma from growing up in the shadow of a legal case that threatened my family every day. But I did. And I didn't want to hear it from him. So it was actually only 3 years later when I decided I was going to write this book that I went back to him. I was happy he was still alive. He was an older gentleman. He invited me into his home. And when he started to question my life choices, he was like, "You're talking about the Google and Facebook. Why? I thought you were going to grow up and fight for justice." And I remember in that moment, I distinctly stopped and looked around his lovely home in the nice part of Queens, not where I grew up, but the nice part of Queens. And I thought, you did what you had to get a nice pension, get a nice retirement. You facilitated a system that destroyed my family's life. Maybe this is your guilt talking.
Wow. You talk about trauma now and your own trauma. I think that one of the things that struck me about the book was, mm-hmm. This idea that I read right before that trauma is hereditary. Mm-hmm. And that this idea that people won't just they're coming to a place for a reason. And I think it's, your story and your dad's story is really compelling. Then there's also the story of your mother and your grandmother, which is which I just feel is the reason why you're here.
Yeah.
Right? And also one of the things I love are the little details about the book that Arthi was born in Casablanca, that she, she writes about her family's unibrow, and that she...
I maintain.
and that she went clubbing in 90s New York and loved salsa dancing. But there's a real thought that
you're... 13 years old or 14 when I started, exactly.
Oh.
Yeah.
This is New
before
York
Giuliani
in the 90s.
Became mayor. It was a lot of fun.
and And so this, I mean, what's interesting is your story, the story of your mom coming is really interesting because she, you know, she felt suicidal before coming, you said.
And I didn't even know that before I wrote the book. I mentioned the judge as somebody I interviewed. The two hardest interviews for me for this book were the judge and my own mom. I am, and for very different reasons, I am incredibly close to my mother. I mean, she drives me crazy. I'm not going to say she doesn't. But, like, we love each other deeply. And she's the most resilient person I know. I don't know anybody on earth with her hunger for life. And so I was blown away when I asked Mom, because I actually started with resentment. When I began writing this book, I had so much resentment I had to work through. Part of me hated my parents, hated them for what they put us through. I felt like I grew up with a really crappy childhood, right? And I was like, Mom, you always say we came here for a better life for you kids. And I was thinking to myself, you're just like a crazy risk taker, you know, lady who just, you know, can't drive well and hurt your kids. You know? And I asked her, I was like, why did you decide with Dad to take three small children and cross the Atlantic and choose to live undocumented in Queens? I didn't get it. Who does that? And then that's when she told me about why specifically we came to this country. Why specifically? My family, my mom was living in what's called a joint family. The Desi people in this audience will know what that is. Joint family meaning that she was living with my dad, his mom, his brothers. My mom explained to me that my grandmother, her mother-in-law, would throw food at Mom, like the plates at Mom, if she didn't like what was made. Mom would have to ask permission to open the refrigerator at times. She'd have to ask permission to leave the home. My grandmother did not allow my parents to sleep in the same place. My grandmother ordered my dad to stay with her, and Mom slept in the living room. This went on for years. Then something particularly horrific happened. I did not write what it was in the book, but I alluded to it. And Mom tried to take her life. She swallowed pills. She didn't want to wake up again. That shocked me because, as I just said, I don't know anyone more resilient than her. So she came back too. She was not successful. I was born 9 months later. I was an accident. My parents brought me home from the hospital. My grandmother would not allow us in the house because I was a girl. She didn't want another girl. So my mom took me to go sleep somewhere else that night. And then my father agreed we could leave and come to America. And this is not unique to us. Many women have this story. Coming to America and crossing the Atlantic or Pacific or Sonoran Desert is easier than moving out of your in-laws or family's home across the street.
And the leaving with the this is the thing that makes me think of it. There's a quote that or something that one of the world's leading, what they call suicidologists, that's not the phrase, there's a technical phrase, said that, you know, outside of America, for women, suicide is a social justice issue. Mm. And I think I think about that because for your mom, America is a bit of a, like she gets here and she becomes an activist a bit. You know, she becomes deeply involved in the community that she's in. It, in a way, gives her a new lease on life. Whereas for your father, you know,
was so different for them. Yeah, no, I appreciate you bringing it up. They reacted to America so differently. Mom came into Queens, into our building. I mean, I talked about the roaches there, but the other thing I should say is that we had wonderful neighbors and we were loving. And like, my parents fled the subcontinent. They fled their homelands because Hindus, Sikhs, and Muslims during the partition of India when the British left were literally skewering each other's babies. Horrific violence. Millions killed and uprooted in that partition. Muslims, Hindus, and Sikhs, as neighbors in 401, my apartment growing up, babysat for each other, exchanged milk, sugar, I mean, my mom saw the capacity in America for people to blend. She always had the sense that we're just human. She sort of, she really deeply believes, she's a very spiritual woman. She deeply believes we are just human. And this was the first place where she saw, oh my God, that's actually the conventional wisdom as she saw it. And that's not to erase how profoundly racism is in the DNA of this country. It is. It's just that it's all relative. And so relative to what she had seen before, in the many countries she'd lived in as a lifelong migrant, she saw in America, people can actually talk to each other without pulling machetes, and women can have a voice. My father hated the diversity. He hated it. And I actually write about that very candidly, because I think that a lot of people react to difference with discomfort, anxiety. They don't like it. I actually have compassion for that. That doesn't mean I think it's okay that you shoot people up. I just have compassion for the anxiety people have around difference because I saw my father deal with it. He wanted to leave this country even after we got green cards. And this is an untold part of American history. A lot of migrants want to leave. It's hard. It's cold. There's winter. A lot of people want to leave. Dad wanted to leave. Mom insisted that we stay. And ultimately, we ended up staying. And that actually caused her a tremendous amount of guilt when she saw that the decision to stay ended up costing her husband's liberty. Yeah.
Wow. That, you know, one of the things that's interesting about this is that, you know, this book is written on the backdrop of the 90s. Mm-hmm. And as I read it, it is hard for you, it is hard for me not to read it. There's two interesting things as I was reading it, and I could only think about the present, even though I was in the 90s, mm. right? And then there was a moment when, I mean, I've told you this, when yeah. September 11th came along, and I was like, holy, like, I just couldn't, I was yeah. surprised by it, yeah. because things were so bad.
Yeah, I was too.
Yeah, and well, and writing the book, yeah. And then, so I wanted to, this, to get more, a little more into today, I guess, it's, because it's important to remember, the bad guy in the story is essentially the predecessor to ICE or ICE. And I wanted to write this down, that mandatory detention was officially authorized by Bill Clinton in 1996 with the enactment of the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty and the Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Acts. Yeah. And so the number of detainees essentially doubled and between 96 and 98, and then again between 98 and 2008. Your dad, your uncle were held in detention. Your dad was deported. Your uncle was deported as a result of this sort of change in immigration policy.
Clinton, not Trump.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. I mean, this is one of the things you said is that, you know, if you were to place blame, you know, yeah. you'd place it firmly in the yeah. Clinton administration.
It's just a factual point. It's, you know, it's as a matter of fact, our current president did not sign the laws that created a mass deportation system in the country. A Democrat did. Part of what's really important to me in this book is to humanize who we are. A lot of what I'm writing is just, it's like a lot of it's just a coming of age story. It's not about being immigrants in particular. It's just like a young girl turning into a woman, figuring out who the heck she is. And it happens to be unfolding in the context of this attack from outside. We're a family, we're people, and then things come at us, right? This country has a crisis, okay? And I try to write about it with emotion and humor because I don't really feel, I'm not making a policy argument, okay? I'm making a moral argument. This country has a crisis. The crisis is this. We've already talked about how open American culture is. You experience it yourselves. If you go to other countries, you might especially sort of see in comparison, like, wow, we're actually relatively doing better here than a lot of places are. You open up Google Maps when you travel and you're hungry any corner of this country. You have 15 ethnicities popping up on your maps. That's who, this country is very absorbent culturally. And then the laws are another story. what Bill Clinton did was really codify the treatment of immigrants and migration as a problem to be solved through crime control measures. Okay. He left. And so here's the problem. And we know this from mass incarceration in this country. Thankfully now, incrementally, there has been a shifting of mindset. And we've come to understand, for example, with the opioid crisis, it's not just lock them all up. There's a conversation about treatment. There's a shifting of the mentality. Clinton, he was really bad for the criminal justice system. He was really bad for the immigration system. Okay. With his crime bill, he actually apologized. He publicly apologized a few years ago for the damage he did to this country. And it wasn't the best apology. It was some, yeah, it was like, it was, but you know, I'm an optimist. He apologized. Something.
Do you want an apology?
Yes. Yes. Well, I do.
What do you think?
You know, you don't even know this. I had an incredibly awkward moment with Hillary Rodham Clinton last week.
Bring on the awkward. You know, that's the radio. That's where the best radio is.
I haven't been
is.
Texting you enough while I'm on tour. The book just launched last Tuesday, and it's been crazy. So Tuesday morning, HRC and I were in adjacent studios at NPR. We were each giving interviews for our new books. She and Chelsea Clinton wrote Gutsy Women.
Look, can I ask which studios?
Oh, in the NPR New York. So I was on Point. She was on Here and Now.
And so you could see her. Is this in the studio?
Oh, yeah. I could see them. And then our interviews ended, and we both ended up in the atrium at the same time. And actually, a crowd had formed to take pictures with her. And I went up there. And I didn't – I have a habit. You might have this habit, too. I don't know what I'm going to say when I open my mouth. I just know that I need to say something. So I just go. And, like, as I said in the book, because I've had some incredibly embarrassing moments in my life because of this reflex, 80% of the time I'm solid, and then 20% is like, ah, Arthi, like, just shut up. So I was, like, in that, you know, I was in dangerous space. You can decide which one it is for what I told her. Anyway, I go up to her. Her handler assumes I want a photograph. I'm like, okay, sure, I'll take a photograph. Take the photograph, and I'm like, congratulations on your book. I just wrote my first book. She's like, oh, that's wonderful. What's the title? I tell her the title. She's like, oh, what's that about? And I'm like, oh, it's about the decade-long deportation case I fought to keep my father in this country after your husband signed a couple of bills in 1996.
Can I say that is... That is some classic Arthi Shahani right there. I swear to you, that is like, if there has ever been a story, what did she say and how did you feel?
Oh, that's my best Hillary impression. And like, listen, I want to say in fairness, it's not a conversation starter. I just had the sense that we were not going to have a real conversation in that atrium, but it was my duty to my family to tell her family something. It was that. My father did not get to matter. I get to matter. You know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
I can't forget him. I can forgive, but I forgive and remember. Okay. So I had to tell her that. Now, in fairness to her, there's not much you can say to that. She politely asked for a copy of my book. I had actually given my copy to Ta-Nehisi Coates, who was also there. And I told him how much I loved his open letter to his son. And I was like, I kind of wrote a eulogy for my father. That's what this is. But we're going to mail her. We've already mailed her the book. And yeah, it was the right thing to say.
How did you feel, though? I mean, like, did you walk away?
Woozy. No, it's just because these things, they're not academic exercises. Like, you know, I haven't read what you were referring to about trauma being inherited. I feel my father in me.
It's interesting. I was this weekend, right now where we're ending, Jews are ending the fast for Yom Kippur. Yeah. I was in Raleigh, giving a talk about forgiveness.
Mm. I saw the post.
Yeah. And one of the things that I pointed out is that Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor, always points out that without no memory, there's no civilization.
Mm.
Like, there's, like, yes. There's, what is it like, forget? I mean, like he said to me once, like, people who tell you forget are not your friends. It is like,
Wow, okay. That's great. the shaman, yeah.
Yeah, and that you take, there's no moving on, there's moving forward, right? That's you. That if we forget these people, we dishonor, if you forget them, then you dishonor them again, you kill them again by forgetting them. But do you feel, I mean, that responsibility you feel, I mean, is, you know, that's, I mean, the part of me that sees you as a colleague and a tech reporter, and I'm like, that's a lot. I mean, does it feel like a lot, or...
What do you mean?
The responsibility. I mean, do you feel as a responsibility, as a burden, or as a calling to remember your father, to...
Yeah, I think it's the calling. I think it's, you know, and we all have this. And this is where I can't emphasize enough, like, this book is not a treatise on policy. It is a reflection on being human and living in a family. We all have inside of us something that glows. And sometimes you pay attention to it and you lift it up and you shine it and you cultivate it and you find out what to do with it. And sometimes you ignore it because often it's out of fear. We call it practical. Like, we have these jokes in society about, like, oh, yeah, and then I kind of sold out. People always say that, kind of like, and then I sold out, right? And I would say that my family has blessed me with a unique insight into the American identity. Not unique, a sharp insight into the American identity. I understand that for all that we talk about and observe in reality, tribalism, which is high right now, this country to its core is actually a place of fusion. For many reasons, and it's not all good, but it's the reality of who we are. And I, you know, the subheading of my book, it's American Dreams, American Nightmares. My father lived the nightmare, I lived the dream, and that is the duality. They both exist, right? Now, there's a narrative in this country about the self-made person. I could be a self-made person. I've been described by many as a self-made person. Doesn't exist. It's not true. I was raised by a network of many, actually, single mothers in my building where I grew up. I mean, my mom didn't do it alone. When my dad was, you know, out and even left for a while because he hated this country, he hated being here, it was a bunch of moms who picked up the slack, right? The scholarships, the teachers, the, you know, like, it was a network of people who paid attention. And it was my father. I mean, this is kind of like the funny thing is that we want to hold up this narrative about the good immigrant. And you know what? For every good immigrant, there's some so-called bad immigrant who was right there in the same home working to pay the bills and get things done to support the family unit forward. So don't pretend that the one exists without the other. It's just not reality, you know? But no, it's not a burden. It's a calling.
No, I was thinking about that. It's funny. There's a little thing about myself. I was sort of on the sly interviewed my mother and I was about my growing up and all of the like random acts of, and so you
look, I'm waiting for his memoir. I think it's gonna be spectacular. Yeah.
So I was talking to my mother and I mentioned like, oh, she's kind of like the Horatio Alger story, and she said, F Horatio Alger, which should be like that's the title hilarious. Because like you said of that portion, because you know, I got, you know, she never paid for really for childcare for me because of, you know, the doctor, you know, gave her when I came in, you know, $5 for a visit. And that's how so many of the, you know, these people get, that's how you have these, you know, immigrant stories. I'm first generation as well. Before we close, I wanted to ask you a question about the current events, which I was reading this morning about ICE and big data, and as the tech reporter, how you know, the government is using big data, Facebook, things like, you know, the that we to go and round up people. I thought about, you know, these mass, you know, these deportations and things like that, but I hadn't it hadn't occurred to me that the difference between 2019 terms of technology and what we can do and find people out. I mean, where do you see that as, you know, big data as a part of rounding up.
Well, there's folks. Also, you know, it's kind of like, I mean, here's the thing is that my book is introducing you to a family who's part of low-end globalization. That's actually the majority of migrants in the world. They're not the elites. They're not the people who go to the Clinton Global Initiative meetings. They're regular people. Now, what's very challenging is in a world that has, in just a century or even less, been aggressively reorganized into nation-state structures, it's very hard to have political stakeholders advocate for the rights of migrants. It doesn't actually fit inside the structure of our political organization. So there's an enormous constituency that goes really unrepresented. I believe in the U.S. that can change, and I actually already see certain political leadership rising up with greater self-awareness. So the fact that surveillance tools, listen, so you've got, you know, for example, Immigration and Customs Enforcement seeking out a huge tech provider, be it, you know, Google or Amazon or Microsoft. Just there are only a handful of providers who can really do this, do their cloud storage. So they can store all the data they have on the cloud and then have, you know, tools to mine it and that kind of thing. The fact that they're doing that is not surprising in the least. And that the things that they're doing might be in violation of privacy. Well, so what? I mean, there are a bunch of migrants who don't have that much advocates around them, right? They can't vote here. I also learned about, for example, agents at the border using Google Translate to decide whether or not someone had a credible fear of persecution. So, okay, Google, and then run through what this person had said. Now, I actually just went to the border before coming on book tour. I wrote the book. I basically put myself into 4 months of intensive solitude in two Buddhist monasteries and an empty lake house. I'm Buddhist. And I got the bulk of this book done then, and then I was cleaning it up, whatever. But it was an intensive period of solitude off of news feeds, off of Twitter, whatever, whatever. And then I kind of came back online, and I saw the images, and I was like, what the hell is going on here? I was like, my country has lost its mind. And specifically at the border, the mothers and children. It's a lot of women and children. And to me, they are not aliens. They are me and my mom. That's who I see there. So I'd gone by the border, and then I came to learn over there. Again, is it really surprising that this administration is not taking seriously the claims of women who have been raped and who are fleeing? Is it really that surprising? It's not to me. That's actually who's coming here. So now these women and children are being forced into encampments on the other side of the Rio Grande. They're not allowed to set foot on U.S. soil. They're camping out literally in tents. They have porta potties, no running water. Volunteers are coming a few times a day to drop off food, water, and diapers. And volunteer lawyers are going over, walking from Brownsville, Texas, for example, to Matamoros, Mexico, to do intake in these open-air, stench-ridden encampments where women are, in open air, recounting gang rape or who was murdered. Or that's what justice looks like right now. You know, but, and this is, I keep going back to this point about the difference between law and culture. The volunteers keeping them alive, feeding them, going to give free legal help, are all Americans. Now, they're not making the top headline. The top headline is the hate, but underneath it, there's actually a lot of love to help them. So, yeah.
Well, I honestly, I am really proud of this book.
Thank you.
I'm proud of you for doing it. It's called "Here We Are: American Dreams, American Nightmares." You can buy it at the back. Before we go, I was saying to you that I was in Raleigh. Giving a speech for between Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah. Mm-hmm. And I gave your book to a friend of mine who was Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor's assistant. And she read it in the night. Oh. And she was like, this is really important. And she wanted me to
Oh, wow.
just reminds you of this quote that Elie Wiesel said, and it's in a book of his. It's in the Night, Dawn, and Day trilogy. Mm. And he writes, and I feel that you've done this, and I am very proud of you, but we must take sides. Neutrality helps the oppressor, never the victim. Silence encourages the tormentor, never the tormented. Sometimes we must interfere. When human lives are endangered, when human dignity is in jeopardy, national borders and sensitivities become irrelevant. Wherever men and women are persecuted because of their race, religion, or political views, that place must, at that moment, become the center of the universe. I really, really, honestly, this meant a lot to me as a first-generation American, as someone who loves you and loves a lot of immigrants. I'm proud that you put, I would say, a lot of your heart. There's still a lot left. There's still a lot of interesting stuff. I would love to see you dissect the tech world and long form and some other parts of American culture.
I don't know that they would love that. But
thank you so much, Aarti Shahani.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you
for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, hear from renowned mystery writer Sarah Paretsky, who visited the AWM in October 2018 to discuss her book, Shell Game. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.